If I were her, I'd want to bury this issue, not make it more prominent. But hey, if she wants to have border events, I think Republicans will rejoice because it'll increase the prominence of this issue.
Yes, still not sure. Still not sure why Kamala Harris went to the border. I guess she figured she had to go there sometime, as the borders are. Anyway, welcome everybody to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Yes, I know she has been to the border before for a photo op, and she was there for another one. This one is not going to do her any good. We can talk about that a little bit later, though. We got so much other stuff we have to talk about on the commute with Carlson today. You know, last week, by the way, sports-wise, last week was such a great week for sports fans. You had the Huskies winning. You had the Cougars winning. You had the Seahawks winning. The Mariners were still in the hunt. Man, what a difference this past weekend. Huskies lose the second another game they could have won. The Huskies should be undefeated. They are not. They are 2-2. Lost a game again. Gave it away with mistakes. This is not an impressive team right now. The Cougars ended up getting blown out. What happened? Oh my goodness!
Close against for 45 minutes, and then it wasn't close.
And tonight. Now, the Seahawks didn't lose yesterday. That's the good news. But tonight they're up against Detroit. This is going to be a huge game because Detroit is a really good football team. They did lose their first game of the year, but they're a good football team. The Seahawks undefeated at 3-0. There aren't many undefeated. Have you counted how many undefeated teams are left in
NFL?
The NFL?
What is it, like four or five tops?
Yeah, there's only 32 teams.
Well, they played games yesterday, and I didn't pay attention, but yeah, okay.
There's 32 football teams, and about four, maybe five, are still undefeated. So the Hawks go against Detroit tonight. That game is broadcast on regular TV, so you'll have a chance to enjoy that. We'll talk to our senior sports correspondent about that coming up. And, of course, you probably heard the Mariners. The Mariners fell out of contention for that playoff spot. But you know what? They did the city pretty proud over the weekend. You know, they won
beat up on the team that's moving to Sacramento.
From Oakland. And
the Nomadic A's.
The Nomadic A's. And anyway, we have some Mariners to be proud of in a very disappointing season. But that's not what I want to start out with. You know, Alaska Airlines is in some trouble. Well, at least they would be in trouble if Clara Jeffrey has anything to do with it. You're thinking, who on earth is Clara Jeffrey? Clara Jeffrey is the editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, and she's very upset because she and some of her colleagues were on a flight to San Francisco.
And that's probably where Mother Jones is probably based. I'm just guessing. But Mother Jones is this progressive magazine, website, political.
Well, Mother Jones was a communist agitator in her day.
The communist, exactly. Boom.
No, she was an old-fashioned commie.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mother Jones, but she was also a hellraiser. And so that's what Mother Jones prides itself on being, a magazine that raises hell to advance the extreme left. All right, fine. The editor, though, is not upset about union issues, not upset about consumer issues, upset about prices.
Didn't get enough free peanuts on the flight, probably.
Yeah, not upset about that. She was offended that the flight attendant wished her and others a blessed evening. That's what has her upset.
Of all the security concerns as we go through the airport to get on the plane, that's what sets you off.
She calls it an example of creeping Christian nationalism.
Lighten up, Francis.
Wound a little too tight there in the offices of Mother Jones. Oh, this is the kind of woman you hope you never sit next to on an airplane.
That would be an insufferable plane ride.
Oh, my goodness. But that is what she's complaining about. And, of course, she's getting roasted online. And we'll talk about that in a moment. What I want to do is update a story that we've been giving you about the Middle East and about what is happening now, not south of Israel in Gaza, where Israel continues to mop the floor with the Hamas terror network. They got another terror network they got to deal with called Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is even more armored and armed than Hamas was in Gaza. Again, keeping in mind, Gaza is to the south, southwest, actually, of Israel. Hezbollah is over the northern border in Lebanon. They have tens of thousands, some people say 100,000 missiles, rockets, mortars, and other projectiles ready to invade Israel. Everyone knows that they will do so if they have the chance. Again, this isn't, by the way, a border dispute over territory. There are no Jews in Lebanon. This is just a radical Islamic group that has perched itself in Lebanon for the purpose of making war on Israel. And they are very handsomely financed and, frankly, run by Iran. Every major move that they make is green-lighted or ruled out of order by their paymasters in Iran. They are very, again, very well armed. They have fired over 8,000 rockets and missiles at Israel after last October 7th massacre of Israeli civilians, again, down in southern Israel by Hamas. So the response from Hezbollah when Israel was attacked was to attack them from the north. Israel has had to relocate 60 to 80,000 of its citizens. That would be the equivalent of about 3.5 million Americans in terms of population comparisons, because they kept raining down rockets on northern Israel. And sometimes they kill Jews, and sometimes they kill fellow Arabs and Muslims who happen to be living in that part of Israel. Remember the story about a couple weeks ago now when Hezbollah fired a rocket at a soccer field and blew up a bunch of kids playing soccer? Those were all Arab kids. Those were Muslim children. They didn't care. Anyway, the man who runs Hezbollah is notorious and is a legend in the eyes of the Islamic Jihad Network. His name is Hassan Nasrallah. I say his name is. His name was Hassan Nasrallah, because last Friday, a series of Israeli attacks blew this guy to kingdom come. And not just him. Here's what is going on. As you know, Israel had the incredibly inventive, creative, ingenious idea of intercepting a delivery of thousands of pagers that were being handed out to Hezbollah operatives, from diplomats to street fighters. Again, over 3,000 of them. They either intercepted the shipment and then added explosives, small explosive materials, to each one of the pagers, or we're hearing another fairly credible story that Israel actually took over the assembly line for the pagers and constructed the pagers, including adding explosives, miniature explosives, to the pagers, which then exploded, which blew up. The official estimates say 30 killed 30 of their operatives. Another of number that is out there says they killed over 800, but they wounded and maimed thousands of others. Blew off fingers, blew a hole if they had it on their hip and their side. If they were looking at the pager, blinded them. If they had it clipped to the front of their belt or had it in their front pocket, I don't need to tell you what got blown off. But the bottom line is that stunned Hezbollah. And then the next day, so we can't use these pagers. They were using pagers, by the way, instead of cell phones, because they thought Israel had hacked and compromised their cell phones. So they said, let's go low tech. Let's use pagers. Probably not a good idea in retrospect. But anyway, they said, forget, we can't use the pagers anymore. Don't even use the old ones. Here, use walkie-talkies. And they did for a day. And then those blew up. And those killed even more people than the pagers did. And then Israel started to rain down fire. I mean, they went Old Testament on Hamas, or excuse me, on Hezbollah. And you're probably thinking, well, wait a minute, these are heavily populated areas. What about all the civilians? Israel actually alerted civilians. They left phone messages and text messages saying, get out because we're coming in. So in the face of all that, Hassan Nasrallah called a meeting in their fortified bunker. When I say fortified, I mean it's 60 feet beneath the surface of a working class neighborhood in southern Beirut. 60 feet down, and it's in a fortified, armored bunker. They needed to talk about next steps. What are we going to do from here? So they call in all their top people. And once they were there, and once they were meeting, Israel struck. They hit that bunker with 80 tons of bunker-busting bomb. The attack used a series of chained explosions to penetrate and obliterate that subterranean bunker. When the smoke cleared, literally, Hassan Nasrallah, who had led Hezbollah for more than 30 years, was dead. They say, well, so I guess now the power is going to be his deputy, Naeem Qassem. That would be, except he's dead too. And so are a bunch of other people in what would constitute their cabinet. The United States, you would think, would be euphoric, an entity that exists for the sheer purpose of killing Jews. That's all it exists to do, kill Jews and wipe Israel off the map of Israel, and wipe Israel off the map of its own country. The network of Nasrallah, Hezbollah, was reeling. It was knocked to its knees. It was on the ropes. And the United States government was complaining about it. Can you believe our government was upset at taking out a terrorist? And by the way, one of his deputies before him, who had a hand in the barracks explosion going all the way back to 1983, killed over 240 U.S. Marines in Beirut. And they've committed terrorism against Americans in other countries. This isn't all about the Jews in Israel. It's about Islamic jihad against the West. So some great work. Again, once again, Israel is not hitting cruise control, and they are not relaxing. They're pressing their advantage. Their foot is on the accelerator. Good for them. We'll have more on this and how this has affected U.S.-Israeli relations. I'll tell you one way to get Israeli relations better, a new president. Anyway, it's 6:21. When we come back, oh my goodness, Philip J. Vandervoort III with the social media sweep. First one of the week. Good morning. Little Bob Seger. All right. 25 minutes now after 6 o'clock in the morning, the commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Vandervoort III standing by with the morning's first social media sweep. Philip J.
Yeah, let's dig into a little local politics here. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And this one comes by way of crosscut.com. And crosscut.com is reporting on this, what will be probably the most contentious, I'm going to guess, legislative race for the state legislature down in Olympia, and it's the Seattle district.
It's between two Democrats.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's
part of the story is what constitutes a Democrat, according to the Crosscut story that I've got here. And this is in the 43rd district where Frank Chop, the former House Speaker, is no longer running for re-election as just a run-of-the-mill rank-and-file state lawmaker in the legislature. Sean Scott is the Democratic Socialist who has run for the Seattle City Council before. We've talked about him a little bit on the show. He's a Shama Sawant clone, essentially.
Oh, and my goodness, yes. No, he's hardline leftist.
Exactly. He's a socialist Marxist.
We and love his opponent,
yeah,
who we've had on the show,
right?
Andrea Suarez, who actually has tried to help homeless people by working with homeless people as individuals rather than just handing out party kits.
Or bureaucratizing
syringes,
it, right?
Bureaucratizing, you know, dispensing services. Instead, she actually, Andrea Suarez, tries to help them by relating to them as individuals.
And the Crosscut story profiles Sean Scott And the criticism of Andrea Suarez from Sean Scott and the Democrats is that Andrea Suarez is not a bona fide Democrat. That's the quotation. Not a bona fide Democrat.
He's the one who's not a bona fide Democrat.
I mean, it's so unintentionally funny that they would resort to this sort of a labeling. You know, you've got Seattle socialists who are simply overrunning the state Democratic Party with pronouncements like this. They call themselves Democrats. They're really socialists or statists. There's nothing democratic about them. They don't like democracy. They want authority. And consider Andrea Suarez's comments about the Sean Scott pronouncement that she's not a bona fide Democrat. Here's the quotation of the Crosscut story. And Suarez says, quote, "The difference between a socialist Democrat and a pragmatic Democrat is that I want people to reach independence. I don't want them to be on the government dime for life. I want to teach and navigate ways to reach independence," end quote. How refreshing is that to hear amid Seattle politics these days?
Well, it's very uncommon, which makes it very refreshing.
And,
again, good
and
for her.
Speaking like that, you're not a bona fide Democrat, say the Democrats.
Yeah, actually, though, you can make a much better case that Sean Scott, her opponent, is not a bona fide Democrat. He's a socialist.
Exactly.
Just as Shama Sawant proudly says, she's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America because she doesn't consider herself a Democrat. Well, same thing with this guy.
She's owned it. So she said that publicly. All right. One more story. This one comes from Cairo 7. And the headline on their story on social media says, "Costly commute? Washington ferry ticket prices increase soon." And that means tomorrow, starting tomorrow, there's going to be a 4% increase if you want to take the Washington State Ferry. And the kicker to this is
yet another increase.
Yes. And the kicker to this is when we get to fall after the summer top, you know, high travel season and vacations, we go into the off season. The ferry rates usually drop. But no. Here's how Como 4 explained all this ferry rate increase.
"Get ready to pay more whenever you drive onto a ferry. Take a look. The cost will go up by $1.45 from $17.20 to $18.65. Again, happening Tuesday. Ferry administrators say it's all because they have to make up money and lots of money. We're talking about they're hoping to recoup $418 million over these next 2 years.
So there's some of the Governor Inslee management of the ferry system, $418 million short, and we still don't have enough staff or ferries to properly run and staff these ferry routes.
Well, let's put it this way. If you want the ferry system to maintain its enviable on-time performance, you're going to have to pay for it. Oh, wait. Yeah, I guess that doesn't fit either now, does it? It is coming up on 6:30, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Oh, my goodness, Macklemore, things not working out well for him at all. Details as the reverberations and pushback about his anti-American remarks continues right around the corner. You're going to hear it coming right up. It's 24 minutes to 7 o'clock in the morning. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Well, like I said about half an hour ago, last week was a great week for Husky fans, for Cougar fans. But this past weekend, well, maybe not quite so much. And you know, whenever we need to consult an authority on the issue of sports, you know who we talk to. Senior sports correspondent Matthew Carlson. Good morning, Matthew Carlson. Welcome to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. How you doing this morning?
It is a pleasure to be on the John Carlson Show this morning. Good morning, Dad.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
a little bit of a tale of, well, it's a tale of the same cities, but a very different tale. Very different results from last weekend.
Okay, well, both the Washington College teams got their tails kicked. My goodness, so their tails between their legs. Yikes.
Yeah, both UW and Wazoo playing night games on the road. I guess we'll start with UW, who played on Friday evening in prime time. They were only one of two games on Friday, and America watched as they went to New Brunswick, New Jersey, and had to play Rutgers in the Big Ten game, and that didn't go too well for UW, unfortunately. They were ambushed. It was a blackout game for Rutgers, and they fall 21-18 and have a long plane ride home.
Well, this was another game that, again, I just think the Dogs gave it away. Yep. I just think they could have won that game. So many, once again, penalties, including some just ridiculous penalties that didn't need to happen.
Frivolous penalties, poor tackling, suspect play calling, missed field goals, although it's hard to blame Grady Gross. He's been really great for UW all year.
Yeah, but I will tell you this. Two of the field goals he missed were under 40 yards. Mm-hmm. And Grady Gross doesn't miss field goals under 40 yards. He's Mr. Automatic, and he missed two of them, pulled them both to the left. And what was that final score, Matthew?
That final score was a three-point game, 21-18. Part of me, though, has to blame coaching on that, Dad. They line him up on the left hash. He keeps missing to the left. Line him up maybe on the middle or to the right, and those balls, with the flight pattern of his kicks, maybe go in. But you keep lining him up in the same spot where he's been missing from. You're just asking for the same result.
Tried a desperation 55-yarder. Actually had the distance, but unfortunately was not able to connect it. Again, it went to the left. Is Grady Gross is like Kamala Harris, is too far to the left.
Push it to the left. And UW falls to, they fall to 1-1 Big Ten play, 2-2 on the year. So Jed Fish era off to a suspect start on Montlake.
What's interesting is that his team that he left behind doesn't appear to be missing him.
No. In fact, me and you this weekend, we saw some amazing football games together, and the University of Arizona did the opposite of UW, Jed Fish's old team. They went into Utah and knocked off number 10 in the nation with a lot of the players that wouldn't follow Jed Fish to Washington. So Noah Fifita, one of the best quarterbacks in the country for the University of Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
He was just electric. But we'll see what UW can do. They have the chance for a marquee upset win. Get ready to shell out money for those tickets, though. Michigan next week on Montlake.
Oh, boy.
University of Michigan.
You see, the reaction in terms of words is the same. A month ago, people said, Michigan's coming to Washington. Oh, boy! Now it's, oh, boy. Anyway, that's going to be this weekend. And Washington State, for heaven's sakes, what on earth happened there?
Oh, boy. Washington State on Saturday night went to a hostile road environment. And hostile is probably a mild way of putting it. They go into Boise State on the blue turf for a blue out, the Snake River rivalry, and they get boat raced 24-45. Ashton Ginty, who was a Heisman on the Heisman watch list before the game. Now he's almost certainly at the top of the Heisman watch list. He ran for 26 carries, 259 yards, and 4 touchdowns.
So he averaged 10 yards a carry.
He averaged 10 yards a carry. Washington State missed, speaking of 26, they missed 26 tackles. They just could not bring him down. The score was only 17-10, Boise State at half, but it did not improve whatsoever in any way for Washington State.
Okay, so let's get out of the past. Let's say, hopefully both teams lick their wounds, regroup, come back stronger than ever. We'll see.
We can talk. Ginty, by the way,
huh?
Has now run for over the running back for Boise State, still kind of regional. He's now run for over 840 yards and 13 touchdowns in 4 games for Boise State.
So he's averaging over 200 yards rushing. Averaging. Yeah. This is just amazing.
Incredible.
If you have a halfback, if you have a running back who averages 5 yards a carry, you've got a marquee player. This guy's averaging 10. And it's not in one game. It's through 4 games. He's averaging 10 yards a carry.
Yeah. So special player up there in the gem state. They got a gem.
Incredible. Okay, so with that said, with the Mariners season sadly behind us,
Mariners note, may I?
Yeah.
So Mariners sweep the soon-to-not-be Oakland A's, God bless them. They sweep the A's in 3 games. Cal Raleigh became the all-time beat Mike Piazza's record. He hit 93 home runs in his first 3 seasons as a catcher. That is a new record. He also hit his 34th home run and has 100 RBI. So,
all right.
Good note for him as the Mariners win that game 6-4. And, but books are closed on the Mariners season.
And, keep the pitching rotation. Just get some people who know how to hit a baseball. I mean, to me, it's very simple. Your pitching's fine. Leave it in place. Don't change a thing.
In fact, the pitching's fine. You talk about needing to hit a baseball. Logan Gilbert, who won Sunday's finale, finished with a 3.09 ERA. That's very good by baseball standards. If you're in the threes, threes. His record was 9-12. He was three games under 500 as a pitcher with an ERA of 3.09. So
he's also the first Mariner since, are you ready for this? Felix Hernandez 10 years ago.
He
had 200 to throw 200 innings and strike out more than 200 batters. That's how good Logan Gilbert is. So, real quickly, we have 1 minute. Tell us what to look out for tonight. Seattle Seahawks, Detroit Lions, Monday Night Football. The Hawks are undefeated. One of the few. How many teams are left who are undefeated? Four? Five?
As of now, let's see. There are only the Bills lost, the Steelers lost, so the Vikings are undefeated, and the Chiefs are undefeated. I believe that's it. I'm trying to think if there's another.
What about
team.
The Ravens? Okay.
And no, Ravens. Unfortunately, they lost. They lost early.
Okay.
The Seahawks, one of a handful of undefeated teams, going to Detroit. This is going to be another hostile road environment, just kind of like Wazoo and UW. They're playing an upstart Detroit team. Jared Goff, who was with the Rams, knows the Seahawks well. The Seahawks know him well. It's going to be a battle for the Seahawks. They have four defensive starters out, two linebackers and two players on the line.
Okay.
So already needing to battle, and watch out for the two-pronged Detroit rushing attack of Montgomery and Gibbs. They will be a force to be reckoned with. However, Geno Smith really having a great season passing-wise, as long as he just does not turn the ball over and passes efficiently, and the Seahawks are able to control the pace of this game.
And by the way,
excellent chance to win.
Kenneth Walker back in the lineup, speaking of running back.
Yes, good point, Dad. So excellent.
That will help as
improvement.
Well. All right, Matthew Carlson, another stellar, superb chronicle of what's going on in the world of sports here. National stories with local angles. Great report. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Always a pleasure, Dad. Great watching the games with you this weekend. And
it was fun.
Have a great week over there.
All right. It's always good grabbing a cigar and a football game with your son. All right.
Especially when it's Alabama, Georgia. Wow, that was awesome.
Yeah, by the way, before you go, Donald Trump was at that game, Georgia-Alabama. This is how the crowd reacted when the stadium public address announced that he was in attendance. Have a listen. Yeah, quite a bit more enthusiasm than Tim Walz received in Michigan.
I Trump's not going to have any trouble wrapping up Alabama, and he's been to a couple games.
Yeah,
now.
No, I think he's got his eye on Georgia. That's the key. All right, my boy. Thanks very much, Matthew.
Right. You got it, Dad. Love you. Take care.
Love you too. It is 48 minutes after 6, and our good buddy Lars Larson, noon to 3, hosts right around the corner on the commute. It's 7 to 7 on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Here's my buddy Lars Larson, our noon to 3 host. Good morning, Lars.
Good morning, Johnny. Hope you had a nice weekend.
I was in your state for Saturday, part of Sunday, watching some football, catching up with my son.
Sounds like a good plan.
Nice summer weather.
You know who else was here? Doug Emhoff.
Oh, that was going to be my guess. The man who would be first gentleman.
Yeah, and he gave what is described as an impassioned speech about women's reproductive rights. It just got me thinking whether or not his view on women's reproductive rights is influenced at all by his experience in his first marriage of getting the nanny pregnant. You know, it might. That might have educated his view on women's reproductive rights, saying, if you have sex with them, they do reproduce, and what are you going to do about that when it's the nanny?
You know, just say if I were a political advisor, if I were a political advisor for the Kamala Harris campaign, I would probably urge her husband, if he's going to go out on the stump to speak during campaign season, maybe not talk about that issue.
Okay, let me ask you about another piece of advice. Mm-hmm. When you're the advisor to Kamala Harris, God help you, but when she's going to visit the border, do you advise her that her accoutrement should include a $60,000 necklace? In other words, a necklace that costs as much as the average American worker makes.
Probably not the smartest call she could have made. It may not be a good idea for her to call attention to the border in the first place.
Yeah, because it's not exactly her finest hour, is it?
Well, it's just been disclosed to Congressman Tony Gonzalez of Texas by the deputy director of Immigration Customs Enforcement that there were 647 illegal immigrants who have been convicted or investigated for...
I think you mean 647,000.
What did I say?
You said the just 647.
Oh, 647,000.
You turned into a Democrat consultant there for just a moment.
647,000 illegals convicted or suspected of sexual assault, homicide, and other serious felonies roaming in the United States.
And released knowingly by the Biden administration saying, oh, we got 16,000 murderers. What should we do? Turn them loose on the landscape. That's what you should do.
Let's turn them loose on the people is what
rapists
they were reading.
And everything else. And this is the result of Kamala Harris as border czar the last 3.5 years is hundreds of thousands of convicted criminals. There are also almost 250,000 who are still pending charges. But the first 400,000 or so are already convicted criminals. The other ones are just accused of terrible crimes.
Once again, if the border matters to you, when we come back, by the way, we'll tell you one group of Americans who you'll be very surprised to learn are very concerned about the border. It's coming right up here on hour number 2 of The Commute with Carlson, right around after your 7 o'clock headlines. Good morning.
He nodded at my guitar and said, it's a tough life, ain't it? I just looked at him. He said, you ain't making any money, are you? I said, you've been reading my mail. He just smiled and said, let me see that guitar. I got something you ought to hear. Then he laid it on me. If you waste your time talking to the people who don't listen to the things that you are saying, who do you think's gonna hear? And if you should die explaining how the things that they complain about,
no,
the things that could be changing.
Johnny Cash. There's actually a song dedicated to Johnny Cash by Kris Kristofferson. Singer, songwriter, by the way, a one-time Rhodes Scholar.
Served in the military, was a helicopter pilot, I believe.
Military veteran, and of course, country music star and songwriter, passed away at the age of 88, his family said, in his home in Hawaii. Get this. He also was a Golden Gloves boxer.
Yeah. And what a life, to say the least, at a minimum. Yeah.
So Golden Gloves boxer, football player in college, Rhodes Scholar, master's degree from the University of Oxford in English, and as Philip J. just pointed out, helicopter pilot, captain in the U.S. Army. He was actually offered a chance to teach at West Point.
That part I had not heard.
The guy who wrote Me and Bobby McGee. Instead, he wanted to pursue a songwriting career. Boy, if you ever wanted a wonderful example of America as the land of opportunity, you can just make your own plan and draw your own life.
Great music stories have turned into fodder for Hollywood movies, music biopics, Ray Charles, Johnny Cash, amongst others. Where's Kris Kristofferson's at this point?
He deserves a place. He was working as a part-time janitor at Columbia Records in New York City in 1966 when Bob Dylan was recording there.
Man, this guy is at the crossroads of everything significant.
There's a guy who's had an incredible life. And, you know, some people say that, it's really sad that he passed away. You know, I don't think when you've led an incredibly enriched, full life that it's sad when you take that next step, you know, toward the hereafter. He was married for 7 years to Rita Coolidge from the early 70s to 1980. And again, just someone who has been an incredible success in so many different, completely different walks of life. That's wonderful. All right. Let's bring it back, ladies and gentlemen. John Carlson Show, Talk Radio, the rest in peace. God bless Kris Kristofferson. Steve Kornacki is the one good thing about MSNBC, because Steve Kornacki is a numbers guy. He doesn't care about political, he doesn't care about voicing his political opinion. He wants to tell you what the numbers are telling the rest of us when it comes to how Americans feel about various issues. And one of the things that he's talking about is how Democrats in increasing numbers are walking away from the Democratic Party. Here is what he had to say over the weekend.
We see every 4 years the Latino vote becomes a bigger and bigger share of the overall electorate. Well, among Latinos, our poll shows Kamala Harris leading Donald Trump 54% to 40%. Now, for some context, this is a little bit better for Democrats than they were doing among Hispanics when Joe Biden was their candidate. But I think the bigger story here is historically, 54% to 40% now is a 14-point advantage for the Democrats. Take a look back at the last three presidential elections, and these were the results in the exit polls among Hispanic voters. That 14, look at that cut there, almost 20 points less than just 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, we were saying Donald Trump had made inroads with Hispanic voters. This suggests that that has continued apace.
Okay, so his point is that she is defeating Donald Trump by 14 points among Hispanic voters, the fastest growing part of the American electorate. But 4 years ago, the Democrats, Biden-Harris ticket, were defeating Trump by 34 percentage points. What happened? Well, Kornacki gives a little context here. It's very interesting.
The biggies. These are the ones that Hispanic voters are saying are the most important to them. Economy, small advantage Trump, inflation, 9-point advantage. And how about that? On the border and on immigration, Donald Trump with a double-digit advantage, 13 points in our poll. When asked who would be better on this issue, Hispanic voters are saying it's Donald Trump. And that is part of a broader shift here among basic attitudes among Hispanic voters toward immigration. Look, when Donald Trump first ran in 2016, 69% of Hispanics said immigration helps the country more than it hurts. That's come down to 62%. And the number who say it hurts more than helps, all the way up to 35%. There's something bigger and broader going on here, and I think you could see it finally with this. We ask a basic question of Hispanic voters: which party do you more identify with? 37% now say Republicans, 49% say Democrats. But again, look at how this has shifted in just the last dozen years. In 2012, this was a 41-point advantage for the Democrats. It has come all the way down to 12 points, Kristen, a 29-point drop.
29-point drop in 12 years. Why is this happening? Well, one of the reasons is that the Democrats miscalculated catastrophically, thinking that by opening the border, it would help them with Hispanic voters. Because, as you know, the Democrats are very much about race. They want a country that recognizes and caters to racial interest groups. And they were thinking, hey, we're going to reverse all of Trump's border policies, and it's going to mean a lot more people of brown skin coming into the United States, and that's just going to help us with the Hispanic voters. Not quite working out that way. Guess what? Hispanic citizens, they don't like people who cut the line any more than anybody else. Hispanic voters don't like seeing working class jobs taken away by someone who isn't even supposed to be in the country. Hispanic voters don't like the huge uptick in crime and violence. Again, don't know if you heard, but late last week, it was confirmed by federal immigration authorities that 647,000 illegals suspected of violent crimes are roaming free in this country. They were allowed to. As of last summer, 425,000 non-citizens were convicted of criminal offenses, and another 222,000 have pending criminal charges against them. This includes, according to Bill Malusian, Fox News, 62,231 convicted of assault, 14,000 convicted of burglary, 56,000 drug convictions, 13,100 convicted of homicide, and 15,800 convicted of sexual assault. So these are the sum total of what we have received from the Biden-Harris administration. An estimated 10 million illegals have unlawfully entered this country in less than 4 years. 10 million. That's the population of Washington and Idaho combined. That's how many they let in. And they thought this was going to help them with Hispanic voters. Oops, didn't quite work out that way. Hispanic voters want many of the same things that every other voter wants. They want a good economy so they can chase the American dream. They can chase opportunity. They can chase a better life. They want safe, secure neighborhoods. They want high-quality schools that are also safe and clean. They want a border that is stable and secure because they don't want all these drugs and all these criminals fleeing other countries ending up in this country. Did you hear the latest? This is out of Nantucket. Again, Nantucket, very Tony upper income area of Massachusetts. Four illegals charged with various sex crimes on the island of Nantucket have been arrested by Immigration Customs Enforcement. This is a wealthy island with a population of just over 11,000 people. Not a lot of people. One of the four illegals is a 28-year-old man charged with raping a Nantucket child. Quote, Brian Daniel Aldana Arevalo stands accused of some detestable and disturbing crimes against a Nantucket child, said the enforcement and removal operations officer for Boston, field director, Todd Lyons. He said he represents a significant danger to the children of Massachusetts. We will not tolerate such a threat to the most vulnerable of our population. But again, he was just one. There were three others. Elmer Sola, 49-year-old Salvadoran illegal, arrested on that same day, charged with 11 sex crime counts against a child in Nantucket. A day after that, Felix Alberto Perez Gomez, 41-year-old Guatemalan national, who had been deported from this country 13 years ago. He re-entered the United States, has been charged with sexual assault and battery. Also charged with that same crime, a Brazilian national. So we've got Central American and South American sex criminals preying on weak and vulnerable people in Nantucket. That's a ways away from the southern border, don't you think? So this is what Hispanics are fed up with and angry about, and they have every right to. This is happening because of the policies of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. She hasn't signaled that she disagrees with a single one of Joe Biden's decisions to reverse the policies of Donald Trump on the border. And when you reverse the policies, you reverse the results. We had a safe, secure border, record low amounts of illegal entry in the United States. Now we have record high illegal entry into the United States for a four-year presidential term. A new high, which is, if you think about it, really a new low. It's coming up here 20 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning. Sun breaking through here. It's a beautiful sunrise as the commute with Carlson continues with Philip J. Vandervoort, the third social media sweep. Talk Radio 570 KVI. The late Kris Kristofferson passed away over the weekend, the age of 88. That is his song he wrote. Me and Bobby McGee became a huge hit, not so much by Kris Kristofferson, but by Janis Joplin. And speaking of hits, playing the hits, the social media hits. Philip J. Vandervoort III this morning on the commute. Go for it, Phil.
Yeah, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. This is one that I wouldn't have expected, and I guess that's one of the main reasons it's worth bringing up. The guy running for Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, David Olson against the incumbent, Chris Reichdahl.
We like him.
So David Olson posted about a two-minute video of a car that is clearly damaged driving down I-5 in Seattle near the old Rainier Brewery and the Spokane Street Viaduct and the West Seattle Bridge.
Okay, so far, that's not a news bulletin.
And he says it's a hit and run.
Oops.
Yeah, and
that's
so
a news bulletin.
Two-minute clip here. And he writes, in a first, I witnessed a hit and run on I-5 South as I headed home from Mercer Island. He's from Gig Harbor. Multiple cars crashed into concrete barriers. I followed and videotaped the fleeing vehicle, called 911, and gave updates to law enforcement as the driver ditched the van and fled on bicycle. Exciting end to my day. And then he adds a postscript to it. It says, turns out, according to the Washington State Patrol, the driver may have ditched the van in front of his own place of residence, then fled on bicycle.
Probably not a good idea.
Yeah, not good strategizing if you're a hit-and-run driver. And the vehicle that's the suspected hit-and-run is coming down I-5 towards the Michigan curve, and it's got front-end damage. It blows out a right front tire. The right front quarter panel is all smashed up and dangling off of the car, and the car is having a tough time staying in any lane. And then finally loses its front tire just after the Michigan exit. There is no license plate on the back of the minivan. It looks like some sort of a Dodge minivan, relatively late model, maybe 5-6 years old. And hopefully they get the cuffs on this person. But David Olson says he's going to a suspect lineup today to try and identify the driver. It looks like the driver in the two-minute video finally pulls over at the Albro exit, southbound I-5. But applaud to David Olson for having the wherewithal to realize that there was a hit-and-run situation and get some video, and leads to an arrest and a conviction.
You know why they're doing the lineup, don't you? Because earlier they had the sketch artist in for David Olson, and he gave the description, and they looked at it, and they said, sir, this is a sketch of Chris Reichdahl.
Hey, wait a second now.
In the general election for school superintendent.
That seems unlikely, right?
No, it wasn't Reichdahl. Good for David Olson for being a good citizen.
And Zach, are we getting that on the KVI Twitter feed?
It's up on the Twitter right now. Yep.
So if you want to see it, follow us on Twitter, which is at KVI Seattle, X Twitter. The handle is at KVI Seattle. You can see the two-minute video, but it's pretty crazy.
Of the car.
Yeah, of the fleeing, what the OSPI candidate David Olson says is the fleeing suspect vehicle.
A vote for Olson is a vote for accountability.
I guess so, man. So keeping the roadways at least a little bit safer in Seattle. Another campaign-related item. Brian Haywood is with the group Let's Go Washington, which has helped get four initiatives onto the November ballot.
Did you use that hackneyed hit piece the Times did on him over the weekend?
I didn't.
It's just so pathetic.
Is this the one that says, let me scroll to what I just saw a summary about it here, posted by the Seattle Times. I think the Seattle Times wrote something to the effect of, where did I put that? Here we go. One man has made it his mission to kill Washington's infant carbon market.
Yeah.
This is the carbon pricing.
He's up
against big name donors and politicians spending millions to save it.
Yeah.
Is that the one?
And then they talk about how if the Climate Commitment Act is overturned and by people voting yes.
Yeah.
And getting rid of the artificial tax on gasoline that's cost everybody dearly.
That hidden gas tax.
That it could shape the climate itself.
Oh, okay, great.
And I love these Seattle Times reporters in their, quote, climate lab. This is a climate lab story.
Right.
I love how they never exaggerate or fall into hyperbole.
Yeah. Well, I brought this up because Fuse Washington has this commercial to vote against the initiatives, but if you want to pay less, you vote yes. So they complain that Brian Haywood moved to Washington from California, and now he wants to do blah, blah, blah. I just find that incredibly disingenuous and hypocritical for the political left in Washington to blame somebody coming here from California when the state legislature and Governor Jay Inslee adopt every California climate law that they come up with, We got to get rid of internal combustion cars by 2035. No new internal combustion engine car sales after 2035. We got to have this carbon pricing scheme that led to the cap and invest scheme that we've got that increases the price of gas here. And they have the wherewithal to complain that Brian Haywood's from California when all they want to do is adopt things that California's already done that aren't working.
Their entire agenda has practically been cribbed from California. Everything from the Climate Commitment Act itself to the deadlines on or to the limits on when they will phase out internal combustion engine sales, all that and so much more. Anyway, when we come back, I'm going to talk to someone who did several stints in prison for drugs. She's going to tell us what is wrong with the entire approach to dealing with drugs and drug addicts in King County and in Washington State, if Inslee and the legislature have their way. All that straight ahead on The Commute with Carlson. Back we are, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. It is 37 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning. Ginny Burton is not someone who a dozen years ago would have been a likely guest on the John Carlson Show. She was a hardcore drug addict, committing crimes to keep her addiction going. Did several stints behind bars. Her latest stint, I think it was her fourth time being sentenced to incarceration, finally made her turn the corner, flipped a switch, turned her life around. Such a huge change that she was profiled by Como TV's Eric Johnson. Showed a before and after picture. The before photo was Ginny Burton's booking photo, where she looked like a strung out junkie. The second was Ginny Burton, lovely woman, hoisting her college diploma from the University of Washington as a Truman Scholar. How about that? So Ginny could have just left that entire world behind. After all, I had some pretty bad memories. Instead, she said, no, because the way that they're dealing with drugs, the way they are dealing with homelessness, the way they are dealing with addiction is making things worse. And people are getting killed. And this problem is only going to worsen with time. The housing first for homeless people is a failure. The harm reduction philosophy for addicts is also a failure. Not just a failure to work, it makes things worse. So Ginny Burton, who we've had on the show several times, has become increasingly active. And now she has made a documentary called Behind Closed Doors. It's not one of those, you know, 2-hour documentaries. It's a 30-minute documentary that exposes the unsafe and drug-filled conditions within these harm reduction housing shelters that King County has set up. And she shows a better way to solve the problem. Ginny Burton, great to hear your voice again. How are you?
I'm good, John. Thanks so much for having me on.
It is wonderful having you here. And you are one of my heroes. I mean, you're someone who just could have said, I've been to that world. I know how awful it is. I want nothing more to do with it. And instead, you're walking back in to try and save as many people as possible.
Yeah, some days that's a heavy load, I'll tell you. But every day, I'll tell you, John, every day where I think about, gosh, can I just leave it alone? And the answer is always no, because I don't see anybody else trying to change that environment. So here I am.
Well, I'll tell you, you might be the person meant to make that change happen. And this documentary is something that's already turning heads. Tell us about it. You're working with changewashington.org.
Yeah. Well, Change was looking at a bunch of the shows that I've done so far. Last year, I covered some stuff on Housing First in Bellingham. And so I met with a couple of folks from Change, and they asked if I would cover some stuff in Seattle, and I said 100%. So I've worked in the industry in Seattle for a number of years, as you're aware. So I know a lot of people that live and work in the buildings. But this specific show, we covered, gosh, we actually did a lot more interviews that actually ended up on the little expose. But we interviewed, and I think we shared at least four or five stories of people that live inside the buildings, at least three people, I think, that work inside the buildings. And we were able to interview Amy Barden, who is the chief of the CARES department, who deals with all 911 data across King County and Seattle. And then her husband, the deputy chief of police, Eric Barden. So we were able to get, you know, a wide view, a wide perspective on the topic. And the thing is I already know what happens inside of these buildings, but I don't want to be a clanging cymbal, so to speak, where I'm out there telling everybody what they should think. So that's what the show is about specifically, is about covering the real life stories of hearing the stories from people's own mouths. And the interesting thing is that I've had so many more people reach out that are living and working in these environments that want to talk to me on camera. So, yeah, it's tragic, honestly.
They've thrown a ton of money into
hundreds of millions of dollars a year just in Seattle alone.
Of millions of dollars a year. Now,
And we have Caitlin McKinney from Discovery Institute, who does a bunch of research in that area, who actually shares on the film as well.
Now, 9 years ago, Dow Constantine, who was in his first term as King County executive, announced that this was an emergency. Homelessness is now an emergency because there were now over 10,000 homeless people in King County. So they've spent all these hundreds of millions of dollars a year since that time. How many homeless do we have now?
Gosh, I don't know the exact number on that, but this is what I can tell you, that in the last year, we've had a 23% increase in homelessness in Seattle alone. And that is after the construction in 2022, I believe, of KCRHA, the King County Regional Homeless Authority, who has a significant budget. They started their own outreach team, which I thought this was quite interesting. And there's actually a study that's been done on this through Discovery Institute. They started their own homeless outreach program with people who were just recently in homelessness. And that first initial budget, I think it was over $10 million, and they housed a recorded number of 100 people with that $10 million. So
100?
Yeah. So at least that's what was documented. There's just been zero transparency. And the transparency isn't just, the lack of transparency isn't just with KCRHA. The nonprofits that they're giving hundreds of millions of dollars to, because they're essentially overseeing the funds that are given, you know, dispersed throughout the different nonprofits in Seattle, such as Catholic Community Services, Lehigh, Plymouth, DESC, all of the major players there that are absorbing a ton of funds, who have also a lack of transparency in the amount of people that are being housed, or the sustainability of the housing, or even the conditions of the housing that are being housed in.
You, by the way, I want to let the listeners know that in the last 9 years, homelessness has gone from 10,047 to 16,385. And the county broke its own annual record last year. 421 homeless people died on the streets, more than one a day. So this is what they're buying us with all the money they're spending. Worse homelessness and record numbers of people dying.
I think something that's really important to mention, John, is that, you know, there's this picture being painted of these permanent supportive housing buildings and how wonderful they are. In the documentary, you hear Dow Constantine singing the praises of these environments. But when you talk to the people that live in them, you're getting a very different story. People are afraid. People are dying. I mean, we've seen in the news twice recently how people have been murdered inside of these buildings. So one of the people on the show talk about a murder that happened in the building. People are talking about rapes and violence. Police are talking about the already stretched and stressed resources and how a significant amount of these resources are being delivered to these buildings alone. So I would be curious to to find the number of people that are dying inside of these permanent supportive housing buildings. And when you have the people that live inside of them saying that they don't feel safe and that they're being traumatized, it makes you wonder what we're actually doing.
Well, what are we doing? And if it's not working, why do they keep doing it?
Yeah, well, I've recently read an article where the goal for providers, and I just want to specify that, the goal for the people providing the environment is not for people's life to improve. It is for them to be off the streets. It's for them to be housed with a place where they can do their drugs. However, you hear staff that are being interviewed on the show talk about they're not even allowed to discuss whether or not somebody wants to stop using drugs. And predominantly the majority of folks that are being interviewed and people that are living in the housing want to improve their quality of life, but there is some sort of barrier between the people that are providing the services and the people receiving the services and actually delivering any kind of improvement of quality of life in that regard. And so I think that those of us on the street who are being
Can you stick with me for a couple of minutes, because I want to ask you a couple of questions here. Ginny Burton has a gripping documentary. It's only 30 minutes long, and you can see it right now. It's at the Change Washington website, changewashington.org. That's changewashington.org. Check it out real quickly. Again, it's obviously free. You can see what it is that is so wrong and so fixable. That's the other thing.
Yes.
We'll get into with Jenny right after this. The woman with the cure for homelessness and drug addiction, they're very closely related. Ginny Burton joins me. She used to be a hardcore drug addict, dangerous person, she would admit. She got all that behind her, and now she is trying to fix the problem before it ruins the lives of, or ends the life of more people. Again, we set records. How many people have died in the last 2 years? Believe it or not, 2,300 people in King County alone. Ginny Burton, so glad to have you here. If people want to hear more, they watch this documentary and they want to hear from you, how can they book you as a speaker or have you come talk to their class at school? Are you available for those kinds of appearances?
Yeah, you can reach me on my website. There are ways to contact me through the website.
Which is?
www.vginnyburton.com or o-ut.org.
Let's go to the first. It's V, Ginny?
Yep. GINNYBURTON.com. They both go to the same place. So
VGinnyBurton.com. Okay, great. No, I want as many people to hear you directly as possible. How long is it going to take for them to dig out and solve this problem? We have 40 seconds.
Yeah, I don't think it would take that long. I mean, look how fast we unraveled with COVID. I think that we can rebuild just as quickly. We just have to be dedicated to really helping our fellow citizen, helping them improve their quality of life and overcome. So it would be an overhaul, but we can do it.
So if you go to changewashington.org, you can see her documentary about how bad the problem is, how the cure makes it worse, and how to fix it all. Changewashington.org. Ginny Burton, you're a saint. Thanks for joining me on the commute.
Thanks so much, Sean. Have a wonderful day.
Coming up here on 4 minutes to 8 o'clock, hour number 3 of the John Carlson Show right around the corner. It's 3 minutes after 8 o'clock, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Thank you again, Ginny Burton. She's so wonderful, and she's so correct. She's so right. Again, her website is GINNY. That's VGinnyBurton.com. That's her website, VGinnyBurton.com. And if you want to see that wonderful documentary that she's made, it's a much easier website to remember, changewashington.org. Changewashington. All right. A lot of fascinating stuff going on in the news as reverberations continue. Israel not letting off the pressure at all. Here's what you need to understand. Here's what you need to know about what Israel is doing. The foreign policy elite and the news media think that Israel is bombing the you-know-what out of Hezbollah, which is the terror network north of Israel in Lebanon. It used to be a Christian country, Lebanon, with a very proud, inclusive, tolerant attitude toward others. So when Arab Muslims began moving in, they were welcome. It's multiculturalism. And as soon as Arab Muslims became the majority, guess who was not the least bit interested in inclusion, diversity, and tolerance? The new majority. And so Christians not only were no longer welcome, they were actively persecuted. Anyway, Beirut used to be, you know, Monte Carlo in the Mideast. I mean, it was kind of city people would go out of their way to visit. You know, you visit Paris, you visit Vienna, you visit London, you visit Beirut. Well, when's the last time you heard anyone mention Beirut in the same sentence with cities like that? So Hezbollah is the terror network for radical Islam. They are basically a proxy. They are doing the fighting. They are doing the dying. They are doing the activity, the terrorist activity of Iran. And they're far better armed than Hamas is to the south of Israel in Gaza, though that's no longer the case, as basically they're running on fumes at this point, Hamas in Gaza, southern Gaza. But up north, they rained down rockets completely unprovoked starting last October 8th. Remember October 7th? That was when Hamas from the south attacked and killed, sometimes viciously, violently, sadistically, 1,200 Jews and some others, and then took 250 hostages back across the border into Gaza. Well, the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, went looking for them. And that has turned into the war that, if all works out as it should, will result in an end of Hamas, an end to Hamas's existence. While they were fighting, Hezbollah attacked from the north, not with troops, but with bombs, rockets, missiles. And so between 60 and 80,000 Israelis, that's out of a population of about 9 million, have had to flee. That would be the equivalent of about 4 million Americans fleeing, say, Arizona, Texas, California, et cetera, because they were under siege. And with Israel all but winning, it was thought that it was imminent that Hezbollah was going to take the position of now or never, this is the time. So what Israel has been doing is a series of steps that are designed to make to discourage a ground war. So this isn't a prelude to a ground war. This is to prevent a ground war. They started, as you'll recall, a couple weeks ago with the exploding pagers. Hezbollah doesn't use cell phones. They don't trust them. They think Israel's hacked their network. So they've been going low tech. They've been handing out pagers to all their trusted people up and down the chain of command, from diplomats to cabinet members of Hamas to street fighters and the entire military chain of command. They've all been given these pagers, thousands of them. And on a prearranged time, all those pagers showed that a call was coming in from Hezbollah leadership. And when they picked up their phone, it exploded, or picked up the pager, it exploded. So no telling how many were killed. The official estimates are 30. There is one estimate that was leaked by Saudi Arabia that said within their own ranks, they say 800 of their own people were killed. What matters is that thousands have been eliminated as a governing threat. They've had limbs blown off. They've been blinded. If they were holding the pager close, their face blew up. But bottom line is the bad guys got it bad. And so Hezbollah leadership said, nobody use pagers anymore, not even the old ones. No more pagers. Switch to walkie-talkies. And a day later, the walkie-talkies blew up. And then came a series of very precise missile hits on homes that were known to be used as meeting areas or even residences for Hezbollah leadership. Well, at that, Hassan Nasrallah, who has run Hezbollah for 30 years, decided to retreat to his incredibly well-fortified armored bunker 60 feet below the surface of a working-class neighborhood in southern Beirut, and called a meeting to talk about where do we go from here. So Hassan Nasrallah and the other senior leadership group of Hezbollah were there meeting to discuss what to do. And what do you think happened? Israel struck. Now, I mentioned they're in a fortified bunker. I mentioned the bunker was 60 feet underground. So Israel struck the bunker with 80 tons of bomb. The bombs used a series of chained explosions. So you would have a huge blast, which would pave the way for a second blast and a third blast and a fourth blast. When it was over, that bunker and the people in it were no more. Just a huge transformative event. It would almost be like taking out Putin in Russia. And of course, when the head of Hezbollah is hit, you'd think, well, then they'll go to his deputy secretary general, Naim Qassem. Yeah, you would, except he was in the meeting and he's gone too. Most of their upper echelon has been wiped out. Israel has continued to hit Lebanon with 2,000 airstrikes that are aimed at blowing up the bombs, the weapons, the missiles, the launchers that Hezbollah has planted in all of these homes and office towers and other buildings. So this has been a stunning turn of events in north of Israel. And it's all gone Israel's way. Now, you're probably wondering, well, what about all the civilians? Well, Israel, believe it or not, actually phoned and or texted everyone with a phone or a text servicing device and said, we're coming. You need to go north, which is what they've been doing. Now, what's the reaction to the United States? Again, Hezbollah only exists for one reason, and that is to attack the Israelis, to attack the Jews, to kill as many as possible. That is their only reason for existing, to drive the Israeli state into the Mediterranean Sea and as many Jews as they can take out at the same time. So you would think they would be euphoric that they got not only Nasrallah, they also got a couple of other people involved with the army barracks explosion back in 1983, killed 240 U.S. Marines. They got that guy. But no, the Biden administration's not happy. They said what we need is a ceasefire. So let me get this straight. An entity that exists to do nothing but make war completely unprovoked with a design on killing civilian is itself being rocked by the Israeli military. Their military chain of command and their political chain of command has all but been wiped out. And thousands of their functionaries have been maimed or killed with the pagers going off. And our take and our position is, let's have a ceasefire, which, of course, can only mean they would have time to regroup. Give them the breathing room they need. Is it any wonder why U.S. officials reported that they weren't informed ahead of time about the strike to take out Nasrallah? It is very unusual for Israel not to do something like that. But I'm glad they didn't. I'm glad they didn't tell the U.S. government, not this government, not the Biden administration. It almost certainly would have leaked, if not directly to Hezbollah or to allies of Hezbollah, then to the news media. So I'm glad they kept us in the dark. They kept us in the dark about the pagers, too. They wouldn't tell us about the pagers. Do you blame them? So the airstrike, which, by the way, was approved by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in his hotel room in New York City. He was staying there to address the United Nations, which he did last Friday. But there are photos of him on the phone in a hallway approving the airstrike. And again, the entire balance of power between Israel and Hezbollah has changed. Israel ain't taking it anymore. They are dishing it out and in heaping helping, and good for them for doing so. All right, Philip J. Vannevort III, right around the corner, your favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. That's when Kris Kristofferson was with the Highwaymen. Passed away at the age of 88. Man, what a life. Rhodes Scholar, Army helicopter pilot, star athlete. I mean,
yeah, or a competitive athlete for sure.
And then, of course, turned down a teaching appointment to West Point so he could pursue a singing career. And I guess that worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Good pick there on the vocations.
Then stepped over into acting. I mean, just what a life. What a life.
I think this is where we call him a Renaissance man, right?
Very much so. And also, just another tribute to what a great country when you can make a life like that happen.
Yeah.
And then
variety of opportunities.
Age of 88 with family surrounding him in his Hawaiian enclave there. All right. What is going on with social media from socialists? Because Kris Kristofferson, certainly no socialist.
Not in that respect. No. So the progressives that equate more laws with better government. I'm going to go through some numbers for you here in just a moment. But it's pretty unintentionally funny how this tweet has played out. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. I'm looking at a post on social media from someone who ends up on NPR to talk about politics as a devout Democrat left winger. Profile on social media says political strategist, national political analyst. Name is Rachel Bitecofer. And Rachel Bitecofer posts a graphic that says bills enacted by congressional session. So every 2 years you get a new session of Congress. So the most recent one is the 118th session of Congress, right? Okay. So it goes back about 20-odd years to the 101st congressional session, which gets back to, I think, 1989. So from 1989 till about 2022, give or take, the congressional session over the course of 2 years would pass somewhere around 300 to 450 bills. So enacting that many laws. And the 118th Congress, which is the current one right now, 2023 to now the end of 2024, they've passed maybe like 10 or 15. It's an incredibly low number. And this Rachel Bitecofer posts this message based on just a very few bills that have passed in this current congressional session. Mm-hmm. Republicans can't govern. Stop giving them power. And it is so unintentionally funny that progressives equate more laws with better governance.
Well,
if you're not passing enough laws, you're just not doing a good job of governing. We need to have more restrictions. We need to have more regulations. We need to have more rules. But that's how we ended up in this whole inflation mess with the previous Congress passing all kinds of amped up federal spending and government spending that exacerbated everything with inflation. And that's just one example. But it doesn't matter if the law is reasonable or good to the progressives. It only matters that a law was enacted. It's a classic quantity over quality concept. But this is what passes for intellectual thought amongst the statists. We need more laws. And if you're not passing laws, you're not being good at governing. But that's what they said. That's what this gal posted on social media about the lack of bills being passed in Congress.
That, again, is how they measure progress. Not by results, but by simply how much money you spend, how many bills you pass, how many executive orders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would you qualify in there. Hey, quick story. I went to a concert in Ballard at the Tractor Tavern, small club show over the weekend.
Yeah.
And the female singer, the band that I went to see was called Black Mountain. They're kind of a progressive rock band. But the funny story that happened at the concert in Ballard, the opening band is on, female lead singer, and she starts talking about how expensive everything in Seattle is. And I was just chuckling to myself as I'm in the crowd that here is, here's a group of people that are basically making their career or earning their money performing in the arts and music world, and they're complaining about how expensive everything is. And she kind of quietly said $12 for a cider, for an alcoholic cider beverage, $12. And the price for a 16-ounce pint of draft beer, $10. $10 for a pint of beer at this venue in Ballard. But
where they were playing.
Yeah.
Well, they're dissing management.
Even the band members were complaining. Wow.
How much for tickets?
Way too, I can't remember. The friend bought tickets for me because I took him to a concert a couple weeks ago. But I think it was like $30, $35 for the concert.
All right.
With the fees and everything.
It's 31 minutes after 8 o'clock. Listen to, if you're wondering what kind of Americans would declare their opposition to the First Amendment, I mean, what kind of establishment Americans would begin to question the use of the First Amendment? I'll give you a perfect example coming right around the corner. It probably won't surprise you. It's a former candidate for president. Oh boy, this is just rich. One of the people killed during that Israeli military strike north of Israel in southern Lebanon was Fatah al-Sharif. Fatah al-Sharif was the representative to Hezbollah from Hamas, the terror network down in southern Israel. He and his family were killed during an Israeli airstrike that targeted their house in Tyre, Lebanon, earlier today. Here is what is richly ironic about this. He worked for the United Nations. Let me say that again. The Hamas leader killed in Lebanon, basically the ambassador from Hamas to Hezbollah, was an employee of the United Nations Relief Agency. The UN, the acronym is UNRWA, they confirmed that he was an employee of the agency, but they said that he was under investigation for his political activity. It turns out that several UN relief employees actually participated in the October 7th massacre of Israeli civilians. And this guy, who is on suspension, but he was actually their delegate to Hamas. Get this, he was also the principal of a UN refugee high school in the area. And he was active in the union. He was active in the education union. This checks so many boxes. Oh, man. I wonder if he ever let his political views get in the way of his instruction. I kind of think maybe that might have happened from time to time.
I'd bet you he did not have a pride flag in his classroom.
No.
A sign that said queers for Palestine?
Queers for Palestine, that queers, probably didn't
queers
happen.
Queers for Hezbollah?
Yeah. But while we're talking about that, gentlemen, an unprompted segue here, Macklemore is continuing to take incoming criticism and incoming fire for expressing contempt, obscenely expressing contempt for this country. And you know who went off on him most recently? Liberal comedian Bill Maher. Here, have a listen.
Quite the reverse. The protests that started off as justice for Palestine have morphed into a broader kind of America is the problem. We f***ed up the whole world thing. Last weekend, there was a pro-Palestine rally in Seattle, and when the rapper Macklemore said f*** America, everybody loved it.
Yeah, f*** America.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a big hit with the Queers for Gaza crowd. Literally advocating for a government that would imprison you or kill you for being queer, from the safety and security of a country that doesn't do that. Yes, America, the only place in the world where a white guy from the suburbs could become a millionaire rapper, because here every person, regardless of race, class, or gender, has the right to be talent-free. Yeah.
All right, well, not only that, but according to Macklemore himself, he is losing gigs. He says he's lost endorsements.
I was at the Mariners game on Sunday, their final game.
Are they playing that Mile My song anymore?
No. Well, they were doing Can't Hold Us at the seventh inning stretch, okay. And that is no more.
Because he kind of did the Mile My Dave Niehaus sort of
yeah, they kind of stopped playing that a while ago, but they were doing Can't Hold Us, I believe. And there was a big call for them to stop, and they did, and now they throw hot dogs from the roof more.
How about that?
All right. Hot dogs from heaven.
Hot dogs from heaven. They're doing that a little more often, it seems. I believe they did that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
First of all, good for the Mariners for stopping any acknowledgement of Macklemore. It would be nice. You know, he's actually a part owner It's a very small stake, but he allows to go around and say he's a part owner, and then the teams could say, oh, yeah, Macklemore, the famous rappers. They both, the Sounders and the Seattle Kraken, have announced that they are mulling over what their options are. In other words, they're seeing if the Heat holds up, whether they're better off just giving him his money back and washing their hands of Macklemore being associated with their team. I hope they do, because this guy is so foul and he's so extreme.
He's just so poorly informed.
Well, and he's so stupid. Yeah. And
this is not the first run-in Macklemore's had with political turmoil. This is an ongoing problem.
Well, he participated in one of those freeway demonstrations to block the freeway.
Mm-hmm. Marching on the freeway in Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, I'm done with this guy. You know, he is so lucky to have been as successful as he was, and he's had a few hits, and now with his career pretty much on the downslope, and it has been for a little while. He starts diving into extreme politics and making a nuisance of himself. Speaking of nuisances, John Kerry, who was the Democrats' nominee for president 20 years ago, was appearing at a World Economic Forum panel and explained one of the chief problems we have in an age swirling with disinformation. And the example he cited were not his own speeches. The example
there would have been many examples of that,
because we've chronicled those speeches and the problem and the disinformation therein. No, his problem is with the First Amendment to the Constitution. I kid you not. Have a listen.
That you're going to have, you know, some accountability on facts, et cetera. But look, if people go to only one source and the source they go to is sick and, you know, has an agenda and they're putting out disinformation, our First Amendment stands as a major block to the ability to be able to just, you know, hammer it out of existence. So what you need, what we need is to win the ground, win the right to govern by hopefully having, winning enough votes that you're free to be able to implement change.
Implement change. What kind of change, John? What kind of change are you thinking about?
Another example of the defenders and champions of democracy that want to restrict your right to express yourself and your ability to speak, or the public's ability to speak. That's the formula.
Yeah.
That's the formula.
That is the problem. Again, it will play the money line here.
You know, has an agenda and they're putting out disinformation. Our First Amendment stands as a major block to the ability to be able to just, you know, hammer it out of existence. So what you need, what we need is to win the ground.
I'll give you an example of exactly what he's talking about when he's describing the problem here.
One source, and the source they go to is sick. And, you know, has an agenda, and they're putting out disinformation.
Yeah, let's see. People only go to one source that has an agenda, and they're peddling disinformation. You know what that sounds like to me? It sounds like the climate change movement. It sounds like what we hear from Greta Thunberg. It sounds like what we hear from Jay Inslee. But our house is on fire. And this Climate Commitment Act, it'll cost pennies. It might even might go down for gasoline. Again, they are the problem. John Kerry is the spokesman for a movement that they claimed it was based on science. It's not based on science. It's based on ideology and almost a near religious like fervor from people who don't have any other god to believe in. But the cord was cut between science and the climate change movement many years ago. And that is why authentic and respected climate scientists like Cliff Mass out of the University of Washington, who used to be celebrated by this crowd, no longer are, because he's still sticking to the science. And as the political momentum for their movement has flagged and floundered, they get more and more desperate, and they exaggerate and distort and lie more and more fervently. So If John Kerry wants to see an example of the problem, hey, man, look in the mirror. Look at your own movement as the climate czar for Joe Biden. It's 11 minutes to 9 o'clock. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Kamala went down to the border. What do you think she found there? We'll tell you right after this. I can't wait to get back into this story. I'm going to hold it till tomorrow. This editor at Mother Jones Magazine, who has expressed dismay with what she calls creeping Christian nationalism, because she was on an Alaska Airlines flight to the Bay Area, and as they were getting ready to disembark, after the plane landed, the flight attendant wished everybody a blessed evening. Oh my God, that's what uptight white liberal coastal elites. Okay, here we go. Let's go from someone who's completely wound, spinning off her bar stool, John Belushi-like, with someone who is cool-headed and very persuasive, Scott Jennings from CNN, talking about Kamala Harris on the border and how she came across. Here's Scott Jennings speaking to Anderson Cooper.
Anderson, it's worse than that. It's not that it took them too long. It's that they actively worked to undo everything Donald Trump had done during his time in office. On the first day, they rescinded all of Donald Trump's border executive orders. The floodgates opened. All these people come rushing across. Then it becomes a political problem. And now, at the end of the election, they want to blame it on Donald Trump. For her entire career, she has wanted a more permissive immigration structure. When she ran for president before, she wanted to decriminalize border crossings. In her heart of hearts, she wants a more liberal, permissive immigration structure. And in his heart of hearts, Donald Trump wants to crack down on the border. That's why when you look at the CNN polling this week, Trump is far more trusted on immigration than Harris. That is not going to change because of this visit today or anything she says today. The die is cast on this issue. If I were her, I'd want to bury this issue, not make it more prominent. But hey, if she wants to have border events, I think Republicans will rejoice because it'll increase the prominence of this issue for the last month of the campaign.
Damn straight it would. Absolutely. Have a great day.